Tonight, we are so fortunate to have Charles Gaines, a pioneer of conceptualism and a highly influential educator who resides in Los Angeles, where he has been full-time faculty in the School of Art at California Institute of Art since 1980. Is that correct? 89, okay. And where he has had an impact on the direction of contemporary art through students he's taught, such as Mark Bradford and Mario Garcia Torres, both of whom credit Charles Gaines as an important influence in their work. With an MFA from Rochester Institute of Technology in 1967, Charles Gaines has significantly contributed to the discourse of art since his system-based grids that debuted in the 1970s, with praise from important conceptual artists of the time, such as Saul LeWitt, who was a real fan of the artist and the work. Mr. Gaines' early work was chosen for the 1975 Whitney Biennial, and he became associated with the likes of John Baldessari, Michael Asher, and Adrian Piper when he landed a position early in his career at Cal State Fresno. He went on to be represented by major galleries including Leo Castelli and John Weber in New York and Margot Levin in Los Angeles, and is now represented by Suzanne Velmeter Los Angeles Projects in L.A. and Paula Cooper in New York. With work in major public collections such as the Hammer Museum, Los Angeles County Museum, and the MoCA in L.A., and the MoMA and Whitney Museum in New York, as well as museums throughout Europe, Charles Gaines received the 2013 John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation Fellowship and has had his work included in numerous group exhibitions of note, including the 2007 Venice Biennale curated by Robert Storr. Now dig this, Art in Black Los Angeles, 1960 through 1980 at the Hammer in 2011. Blues for Smoke at LA MoCA in 2012, and most recently the 2014 Montreal Biennial, and this year's 56th Venice Biennale, All the World's Futures, as well as the inaugural exhibition of the Whitney Museum of Art of American Art, titled America is Hard to See. His solo exhibition, Gridwork, 1974 to 1989, that opened in 2014 at the Studio Museum in Harlem, is currently on view at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles, where the press release makes my case that the importance of Charles Gaines and his art cannot be overstated, remarking that his early groundbreaking work, quote, serves a critical bridge between first-generation conceptualists in the 1960s and 70s and those artists of later generations exploring the limits and subjectivity in language. And tonight we have the privilege to hear directly from one of the important thinkers and makers of our time. So please join me in welcoming Charles Gaines.
Thanks for that very generous introduction. When I talk about my work, I love talking about my work. So usually it takes me 3 or 4 hours to talk about my work. I found out that that's not going to happen tonight. So I decided to focus on a particular moment or a particular period in my practice, some of you might know the early work that dealt with numbers and systems was the mainstay of my practice up through 1989, 1990. And in 1990, my focus switched to dealing with text and language, keeping the same interest in systematic work. My general interest in systems was that it provided me with a way of using a strategy of production that didn't involve the direct use of my subjectivity. By invoking the system, the work was produced by that system and its production, at least in terms of on my part was essentially perfunctory. And needless to say, I get into a lot of arguments about this when we talk about the work, because people continuously tell me that they recognize my subjectivity here and there in the work, and I'm always denying that it's not. So, but we won't get into that argument tonight. But I will talk about still that very same issue, which is still very important to me. Because it was motivated by a disinterest in making work that I call expressive art. A discovery I made when I was in graduate school that I had trouble making work from my intuition. It's not that I couldn't do that, you know, because it's not hard to make stuff up. But that it didn't seem to mean much to me, and I discovered by investigating art from other areas, for example, tantric Buddhist art, that there are places in the world that didn't make work out of from the standpoint of the subjectivity, and that discovery, along with certain practices in conceptualism, in particular Hannadar Bolvin's work. It gave me the idea that by employing a systematic production, that I didn't have to rely on the sort of the intuitive insight, and so in any case, that led into the production of the numbers work for all those years. I was involved with studying semiotics and language theory, you know, probably from the late 70s on through the 80s. And I was doing a lot of reading, starting with Roland Barthes and continuing with Umberto Eco, later with deconstructionists like Derrida, and finally, winding up with the post-colonial writers like Gertrude Spivak and Edward Said, I began to realize that that language itself is a system of language, a function very much like the way that I use systems in the early work. That by approaching the idea of language as a structure, you reveal how language itself produces, beyond the. Beyond the realm of your own intentionality, or I would even say that that we employ what language produces and we claim it to be our own, so I started working with this and felt that rather than working with grids and numbers, that photography and text became a much more useful tool in exploring this. So essentially. The work employs the use of the systematic aspect of language by collapsing or conflating or pulling together things that are unrelated, and then finding that in perception or in the perception of the work that relationships are formed. Meaningful relationships formed between things that are completely arbitrarily related. And my claim was that that sense of meaningfulness was produced by the language system itself and not by any intent on my part as a producer to make meaning. So the work that you see in front of you is the first series I did with this sort of investigation. It's called Night Crimes. And let me explain it to you how it works. The Night Crimes, what I did was that I researched the L.A. Times archives of both crime scenes and photographs of convicted murderers, people who were convicted of a capital crime. And as you see in this piece, I put them together within a single work. Now, this comes from a body of photographs that I go through and select and pair up. Now, And if you think that I was using my subjectivity and making these pairings, guilty. You're right. I don't think that I had to do very much of that because I was dealing with a single subject, and that was crime. And so the linkage between photographs, even if the crimes had nothing to do, the two photographs with respect to crime had nothing to do with each other. In other words, they're not reflective as a single crime. They're nevertheless organized around the narrative of crime. And that's enough to make them seem meaningful in relationship to each other. So I would make these pairings, and in this piece you can see the guy on the left is a convicted murderer, and on the right is a crime scene. I got the photographs from, as I said, the LA Times archives that UCLA, in fact, held, and I got permission to use them. I found the date of the crime and its location, and consulted these people who are photographers, amateur photographers, who go around the world shooting, taking photographs of the night sky. So I contacted one guy and asked him if he would allow me to use his photographs, his night sky photographs. Because what I wanted to do is that I wanted to find the night sky that was present at the moment that the crime was committed. And if this crime, for example, that is represented in this piece was committed in 1970 on June 1st at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, then I can find the night sky that was present. You know, I mean, it's daytime, but the sky is still there. The stars are still there. And at that very moment, and use the photograph that charted that section of the night sky. So the photograph of the night sky became the third element. In the middle, the text that you see is makes a correlation between the location of the crime and the location of the night sky. The night sky is articulated in terms of right ascensions and declinations. That's the XY axis of the celestial sphere. And the Earth is longitude and latitudes. And so as you see there, the ascension and declination numbers of that area of Los Angeles, where the night sky was, and it made a straight line. It's theoretically perpendicular to the point on the Earth where the crime took place at that longitude latitude, as if to say that if at the moment of the crime, the victim and the murderer looked up at the sky, this is what they would have seen. Right. So the issue is that none of these things are related. It's an arbitrary collection of images. There's no causality in between them, except the causality that's produced by the narrative itself. And the narrative itself is a fiction. But it occurred to me, or at least I felt very strongly, that even as you feel it was a fiction, you still felt it was meaningful, that it produced the meaning. It's opposed to a situation that you would perceive to be chaotic or arbitrary, where you would realize the arbitrariness of something because it doesn't produce meaning. This is no less arbitrary, but it does produce meaning. My interest was to suggest that this meaning is produced because of the structures and systems of language, the way they operate, the way we employ language. Seemingly, we use words as an expression of an intent, and we locate the idea of intent around the idea of our subjectivity. Position was that we select already from existing meanings a combination of signs that produce a single narrative. So all these, they're already existing, and intent is wrapped up into this sort of prescription of language. In other words, the fact is that we are limited by the language system itself. And even as we use it, we don't feel that limitation. The other part that I was interested in is the affect that this produced. Now, when this work was reviewed, it was argued that it reminded one of noir narrative, like noir cinema, or crime scene narratives, and so forth, and it invoked certain notions of suspense or the sublime, or even, in particular with the sublime, the idea of a certain sort of terror that we are, at any one of us can be a victim of a crime at any second. The feeling that this sense or let's say this perception of vulnerability produces is in fact produced by the language system, and which then informs our meaning. That is to say, that it's through language that we can get a sense of the infinite, a sense of the unpresentable, a sense of the unimaginable, and the associated feeling that it produces. Now, I propose this as an alternative to the idea that the emotions exist first and is expressed through language. I think it's almost the other way around, or at least a collaboration between interior intentions and what's available to us within the language system. The language system makes us or allows us to think, for example, of the night sky, as in this case, as in some way representing or having some kind of meaningful relationship with the idea of death, or the idea of the uncertain, the limitless of the night sky, and the uncertainty of life become a corollary. I mean, they sort of become a metaphor, let's say they form a metaphor. And the metaphor that they form produces the sense or the experience. Now, I propose this, trying to generate the notions of feeling and emotions and aesthetics through language as an alternative to saying to the conventional idea that these things are produced by our subjectivity. So I wanted to map that out, the night crimes, to map it out, to try to give you a sense of my intention and the fact in my method of collapsing or conflating things that are not that are arbitrarily related, but yet inevitably form a sense of meaning or intention or purpose, even as you know they're arbitrary. And so I'm going to jump, because that night crimes was done in 1993, so... I'm going to jump a few years to this piece called Manifestos, Manifestos 2, that I showed first at the Paula Cooper Gallery in 2013, I think it was, and later it was shown at MoMA, and at present it's being shown at the Contemporary Arts Museum in Chicago, and a show there that's called The Freedom Principle. So, the Night Crimes, the installation is made up of a couple of parts. One is a part is a video installation, which you can see there on the left, and the other part are drawings that you see on the right. So, what I did to realize this work is that. I researched various texts on social justice texts. In fact, I was looking while I was working this piece, texts that were self-identified as manifestos. And so I selected four for this piece. And we'll get into them in a minute. But my intention of selecting them was to edit the manifestos down because manifestos, I mean, people who like manifestos, who write manifestos, can't seem to stop writing. They go on and on. And so I only needed like 300, 250, 300 words. So I picked a salient section of the manifesto. And so I took that text and applied a system to it where the letters of the text are converted into musical notations. So, for example, the letters A through G are used in musical notations. So let me advance a little bit so you can see how it's going, at least in the drawings. The letters A through G are used in musical notation, and where they appear in the text, I write them in terms of the system, music system of music theory, as a musical, a musical line. The letters that are not used in music are converted to silent beats or rests. So on this sheet music here, what you see there, you can see this is conventionally a musical score that's written for piano. So on the top line is the melody, and that's what you that's, let's say, a singer sings that, or an instrument plays that. And on the bottom line is the chords, the piano chords. So the melody, if you follow the melody line, you see letters of the text underneath the notes. And so where there's an A in the text, that note is the note A. Where there's a B in the text, it's a note B. Where there's a letter that's not used in music, like an I or an M, then that's a rest. And so that's essentially the way the system of application. So what I did was that I scored the four manifestos. I scored the four manifestos according to the system, and I took this score, and as I said, I wrote it for piano, and gave it to Sean Griffin, who is a composer that I collaborate with in these pieces. And he scored an arrangement for an ensemble. In this case, the ensemble is a nine-piece ensemble. It's a string quartet, piano, trumpet, bass, and harp. And also there's and in this piece there's a singer too, so there's a vocalist. We recorded it at a sound studio, and then I had the text turned into a video, each text, so you can see each one of these represents one of the texts. The one I'm going to play one for you, we'll play a video for you here, which is the third one. It's the Malcolm X speech in Ford Auditorium. And one, not yet, yeah. And one and you'll see that while the text is scrolling, the music is playing along with it. Now, in the installation, we have four monitors. So if you walked into the installation, if you walked in at the beginning of this process, you'll see first the left monitor text scroll, and then that's over, that monitor turns off. The second monitor turns on, and the... that's the Malcolm X. And then that goes off, and then the third monitor, the Indocumentalismo, is a manifesto about the indigenous, the undocumented. It was a manifesto that argued that undocumented should be a protected class. Anyway, that scrolls, and then fourth is the rights of women, which is a manifesto written in the 1700s, following the French Revolution, and it was written. The argument in the manifesto was that the men of the revolution, after the revolution was over, told the women to go back home and wash the dishes again, before they were fighting in the streets. And this manifesto is essentially saying we're not going to do that. So that scrolls. And then there's a final one where all four scroll at the same time. So let me go back to the drawings, because there are these four large drawings that accompany the manifestos in the exhibition, and while you're watching the scrolling text and while you're listening to the music, you can actually follow it even as if you don't know music theory, you can literally follow it in the drawings. And the system is actually very present to you, and you don't need music theory to figure it out. These are a couple of close-ups of drawings. The drawings are hand, they're all graphite drawings. They're no printing, printing process is undertaken. Okay. So, we'll play the Malcolm X scrolling video right now. All right. Can we get the music back, the sheet music back up? So, as I said, that I scored for piano, and so. The detail of the system is that the top line is what you heard the trumpet playing, and but the trumpet, that's the melody line. So the trumpet only didn't take that on the responsibility. The other instruments in the ensemble would take it on at various points, and so the bass picks it up. The some pizzicato by the violins pick up the melody, the harp picks it up in some places, so it circulates. And in the bottom of this chord, so those long extended chords are what you see at the bottom, on the bottom two lines. And those are also systematically realized. So that, for example, if you take a word like and, the first letter in the word and is an A. So the A note is written on the melody line, and underneath it a chord, an A major chord is written. Took the liberty of using four types of chords, a major, minor, diminished, and augmented. and I cycled them every two measures. Staying with that system, the music is produced. Now, the way it relates to my discussion about night crimes is this: is that the music and the text are unrelated. They are arbitrarily related. They're brought into the same sphere through the system. In other words, the system is similar to the systems I used in the numbers series early in my career. The systems place them within the same context or a contiguous relationship. You know, so the music sounds emotional. The emotionalism of the music. I'm really a deeply emotional guy. But I wasn't interested. I don't like art that throws its emotions all over the place. So I want to apply this critique: is that emotions is not produced so much by your subjectivity, but it's produced by the system that you're using to express. And so in this case, the diatonic scale of your Western European music is producing the emotions. And also producing the sense of relatedness, as you might read the text and give it a certain character that's produced by the music, that is employing what you call sort of a metaphor. That at the very end, the word "crack" scrawled out of place, and it seemed to be appropriate. With that last note, but it was it's arbitrary. Any note would have worked. It just would be an end because it would feel like an ending because of the system of musical notation provides that and produces an effect. I invoke this kind of critique because I want to make an argument about art that art has to be a critical process and not just a way to have an experience. The experience is there, but the experience is important because it has some critical import in terms of culture. And Western art has argued for many years that the purpose of art is to have an experience, and that's enough. And that experience is a consequence of at least in terms of late, high modernism or early modernism, at least that experience is a coming together of the subjectivity of the viewer and the subjectivity of the art maker, a correlation that is not arbitrary but intentional, made intentional by the genius of the artist. So that's what I feel about it. I giggle too, you know. So the idea is that I wanted to make an affective work, but not have that affect be the result of any intention of producing affect. Right. So the last piece of play is the series. Unfortunately, this is the piece I showed at the Venice Biennale. And unfortunately, we don't have good images of the entire installation, so I can't show you those slides. But we photoshopped this combination, which represents one of the four sets of pieces in this work that I call sound text. And in this work, this work is similar in the sense that music and text is being employed. But the way it's being employed is different. In this work, I actually researched musical scores, archival scores that had, something to do with issues of social justice, and unfortunately, this lecture isn't long enough for me to get into my ideas around art and politics. And that was, you'll have to wait until I come back for that. But in this piece, I used old pieces having to do with social justice, and this one is a music score that comes from a Negro spiritual called Deep River. So we took the actual score, and I took this and matched it with a Susan B. Anthony speech. So I removed the lyrics of the original lyrics of the spiritual, and replaced it with the Anthony speech. Now on the top line, you find the actual melody of the spiritual. Underneath that line, you find Susan B. Anthony's speech. Below that, you find the chord, the music, the piano score, and so the chord sequence that was in the original music, the original Negro spiritual, again was removed and replaced by a chord sequence produced by the same system that I used in manifestos. So the relationship between chords and melody are arbitrary. The relationship between words and, let's say the lyrics and melody are arbitrary, considering that the original music, these aren't the lyrics from the original music. And we again had this recorded by an ensemble and in a sound studio, and I made these four pieces where these triptychs, where the music is the first and second piece, and the third piece is the scrolling text. It's a monitor where the text scrolls while the music plays. So we're going to I'm going to play the scrolling text, the scrolling video from this work. Should we have the lights? Yeah. As I mentioned, I just want to repeat that the melody that, you know, which is pretty pronounced, is from the original spiritual, but all the chords, all of the accompanying notes around the melody are produced by the system, and so there's a lot of atonality in this piece that doesn't sound offensive to the ears. But I didn't know he liked it that much. Yeah. the nature of Western notation is such that it intends to produce melodic sounding notes or note relationships. So you can pull letters out of a hat and sequence them and have Itzhak Perlman play it on a piano or on a violin, and it'll sound beautiful, you know. So I wanted to make a point of that even in the case of affective experience, that the role that culture or the social space plays in producing that experience is enormous. And it is a way of critiquing the idea that it is a solitary kind of experience produced by, this is a kind of intuition or subjectivity. The problem I have with those constructs is that they are used to make art unavailable to critique or unavailable to the intellect. It reinforces the idea that there's a binary difference between feeling and meaning, or feeling and reason, and so I wanted to dislodge that construction, and say you don't have to give up affect when you employ intellect. You don't have to give up your feelings when you think, and vice versa. Anybody agree with me? All right. Well, that's it. I thanks so much for listening to me. Sure.
Why do you draw?
Well, I have a drawing practice.
Right.
The reason I went to that is, I mean, it's still the reason I continue to do it, and that is drawing produces a more neutral language with respect to representation than painting, and so I wanted to maintain it in terms of that sort of graphic import of drawing, and maintain a closer relationship to the intellectual practice. Materiality, you know, materials are very powerful, and the language that's used in art to sort of control and use materials in art production is built around the idea of it's we've been taught to read that as a manifestation of our subjectivity, but in a very complicated way. But in the drawing, you can reduce that. You know, it's not that, you know, you have this one element of drawing where it's a direct consequence of your hand. So it's still tied to the body. But but at the same time, it is a way of making image and making marks that is less complicated. You know, is less layered. And to that degree, it exposes, because my purpose is to sort of unpack or unveil the notion around subjective expression, that the image is a function or is a consequence, a cause and effect relation between a subjective intent. And I want to unpack that the materiality gets in the way, it occludes the unpacking of that. And so if I keep the process simple, then I can lay out, I feel, the skeleton of that strategy, you know, and therefore the source. I think that the source in terms of these pieces go more directly to the images go directly to their source. And for example, in this piece, you know, this is a graphic process, but it goes directly to the archival document. And what is whatever you experience has been large part produced by that document. It's not, you know, layered over, except for the fact that I use my hand. You know, and but it doesn't. The use of my hand doesn't reduce or limit or even make unimportant the archival nature of the document. The document, you know, it retains its location as a product of culture.
Is there any relationship between the kind of time and contact that you have in the process of drawing and the slow process, the super, super slow scrolling of the text? Like, that's what came to mind to me when I saw the drawing. I think of drawing as something that engages you over a period of time versus, say, typing it on the computer, you know, typing it on a word processor.
Yeah, the drawing keeps you oriented around the body. Yeah, but for me, there is no metaphorical read of the use of drawing. For me, it exposes full face production, and the early work, you know, with the numbers and trees, and before you see production is just right in front of you. You know, and you know that all of that time was simply perfunctory. You know, and the same thing with the music. You know, there's no artness in the production of the images of the music. It's just labor. You know, and to that extent, that I try to limit the metaphorical interpretation of that, and keep forefront the idea that, you know, it's labor. You know, it just takes a long time to do these things. You know, the issue of labor is all is hidden in most art, except in the case where we sort of have the desire to give value to labor. You know, that, oh, it's a good work of art because it took a long time to do. You know, but most of the time, you know, you're not supposed to think about that. But labor is the incursion of culture into the process. And so I'm trying to keep that in the forefront. Yes?
I was wondering about your relationship with music. Are you?
I'm sorry. Can you a little louder?
Do you play music yourself, or is there a? How do you know music notation? Did you study music?
Yeah, I was trained as a musician. Yeah.
Is that a secret, or does everybody know that?
I guess anybody who comes to my presentations know it, you know.
You're a jazz
drummer? Yeah, I played jazz drums when I was younger, up to the time I went to graduate school, and then I stopped playing professionally. Okay, here and then there, right there.
I understood the words much better at the speed it was going. Normally I read them, but I don't comprehend them as much as I did today.
In fact, a lot of people comment that it seems to have a certain affect to the experience because you're reading the sentences over and over again. And some of those sentences are pretty tough.
Yeah.
You know. Yes.
I'm a writer, so I'm always curious what people are reading, what music they're listening to, and I also wanted to know what's the impact of other art forms on your work.
Most of my reading deals with critical theory, you know. So political texts in general. I'm a big fan of post-colonial writing, and occasionally I'll read a novel or short stories. And so. And I'm not sure I understand the other part of your question having to do with other art forms.
Sort of the impact of, or how do the other art forms impact your work? Could you talk a little bit about that?
I'm more interested in shared ideas between the different, you know. Like, for example, when I was very interested in minimalist music in the late 60s because the ideas behind it seemed to reflect my own search in my practice for a systematic practice, and I have been always interested in European Romantic music, I couldn't figure out for years why, you know. But I think it was because I mean it seems to be showing up now. I think it's because of the strategies that Romantic music uses to poeticize sound, you know, particularly in terms of affect, and I have this interest in affect. I mean, I think that as related to art, because I think it has to be really scrutinized because it can just seduce you into oblivion, really, you know. So I was interested in the intellectual strategies that Romantic composers use to produce affect. Yeah, that interests me more than any kind of experience that I might have listening to the music. And jazz, you know, and it was, you know, it's just Sonny Rollins, it's melodic music, but I was also interested in the Chicago new music ensembles in the 60s and 70s, and how they were very successful at merging European avant-garde music and American jazz, excuse me, American music. In other words, making them the same, you know, the same part of the same
sort of a theoretical investigation into music. Whereas before, you know, jazz was thought to be somewhat a popular form, even though the jazz musicians didn't like that. But 60s, 70s avant-garde jazz went far into change it. So I listened to a lot of that, and I still do. Any other questions? Yes.
Are implementing systems a way to create a boundary or a border, a control over emotion, and sort of the manipulation that emotion has?
Yeah, not to control it, because I mean the emotions are spilling out all over this work. So, but I wanted to make it available to criticism. So the system, making the claim that the system plays an important role allows me then to critically consider the experience you're having. Whereas, like one of the things I remember, playing one of these pieces at a talk in New York, and I went into the same long spiel about systems and criticality, and you know, the same long spiel I'm giving you. And ultimately, after my talk, a group of us sat on the stage in a panel, and ultimately I realized that no matter, you know, after all what I said, you know, the people were saying, "Boy, that's some beautiful music," you know, and that's what they got out of it, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I struggle to make the to give its critical import, a certain kind of important, you know, a presence, but it's difficult because it's hard to, emotion is so seductive and powerful. It's hard to try to think rationally about things in the presence of it. You see. Yes. Well, in the back there first, and then here.
Do you see yourself as the forefather of glitch?
Glitch?
Are you familiar with glitch?
No.
Well, glitch is usually done on computers. So you would, say, take an image file and open it up in a hex editor and do random substitution on the coding inside the file, and then save it back, and then if it didn't destroy the file altogether as a image file, then you can open it up, and it will have taken on a bit of its old shape and a new shape that the glitch infusion has put in there. So this is a common practice for image files, for video files, and for music files, and it's also a means of generating noise. So I see a lot of what you're doing in line with that practice.
I'm glad you're calling me what did you say, a forefather of it? I'm glad to be a forefather of something that I know nothing about. But I want to follow that up because, yeah, I think that the awareness of systems operation, there obviously is a connection there. But one of the problems that you have to be careful of in that is not to be just fascinated by the system itself or the cleverness of it, sometimes, the fact that you suddenly become really invested in robots because they act like people, right? You know, and so you got to be careful of that because that's the other side of the same problem where you're not really thinking critically. You see, you're